We're going to open the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, to chapter number 8, verse number 5, and continue with this opera that is celebrating physical love, mind you, but the passionate love between a man and a woman as they look forward to being married and to being fully intimate with one another. Now, the last verse that we looked at was a repeat of an idea that keeps popping up. It's being sung by the lady. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. That love needs to take its time. You need to not rush it. You need to be patient and wait for it to grow and find just the right moment for it to climax into to what it needs to be. And I think that may be, in fact, the overarching theme of this opera. Now, in verse number 5, I think our our English Standard Version translators may have missed a place where there's a chorus that chimes in. Just my opinion. I believe that after she finishes with that in that admonition, repeated admonition in verse 4, that the chorus, probably the men chorus, chimes in and says, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? So they draw attention to kind of a change in scene, is my thinking. And then we go back to probably her singing, saying, under the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. Now, it's possible it might be him doing the singing here, because we just read about her wanting to bring him home to the mother that gave birth to her. So it's possible that there is a little quick something from him saying, I brought you to awakenedness there under that apple tree, that fruit tree, close to where you were born, maybe. But I think we do get back to verse 6, seems to me to be her singing to him. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. Now remember, the chorus, I think, just mentioned, who is this coming from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? So they're together. He's escorting her. And so she, I think, is singing back about that, that she wants him to seal her upon his heart, to seal her upon his arm, make her a permanent part of his day-to-day life. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. So love is very strong between two persons. When that relationship develops over time and really gets set firm, it worries. It's concerned about any intrusions upon it. That's the jealousy thing here. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord, the flame of He who is, probably a reference to lightning. And so we know how that works, don't we? People who have a very strong, passionate relationship, and then something intrudes on it, there can be very strong reactions to that. Don't get between a passionate couple, right? Verse 7. Many waters cannot quench love. You cannot drown out true love. It is powerful. I've already made one Princess Bride reference in our look at the Song of Songs. I might as well make another one. When Wesley has been almost killed Miracle Max is trying to figure out if he's got anything to live for, and his response is true love. Because death can't even kill true love. That's the story in The Princess Bride. My apologies to those of you that don't know the film. But this is true. When you have a husband and a wife who are passionately best friends, that cannot be so easily erased. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. So if somebody were to try to buy love from somebody else, I mean, I'll pay you $1 million not to love that person anymore. Are you kidding me? You couldn't offer me all the money in the world not to love my wife, not to love the wife of my youth, my best friend. Because love is powerful. And again, I think that's really the thrust of this opera. Then we have the chorus jump in. Probably, it may be a mixed chorus at this point. It's a little hard to tell. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. So she's either still an adolescent that has not yet fully blossomed in her body into a young adulthood, or maybe she is one of those who genetically just does not have very large breasts at all. And so the chorus sings, "We have a little sister, she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for?" Meaning on the day of her betrothal, when she's going to get dressed up and go through the ceremony of promising to be the wife of the man who's promising to be her husband, and things are exchanged back and forth. How are we supposed to make her look really fantastic on that day? And verse 9, they answer their own question. If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. So apparently, there's going to be some interesting costuming. There's going to be some interesting dresses or clothing that they're going to use to accentuate her beauty, even if that does not include a very ample bosom at this point in her life. Verse number 10. This is where the lady now chimes in. She sings back, "I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. And then I was in his eyes as one who finds peace." So she remembers, perhaps at the very beginning of their acquaintances and things, that she was perhaps noticing that that he was noticing her. Noticing her shape, noticing how she looked. And very often, let's be quite honest about this, very often relationships start from a physical attraction. What we see, what we hear, smell or taste, touch. And then it should grow on beyond that and take in all the other aspects of personality and intellect and spirituality and things of that nature. So she may just be thinking way back in at the very beginning of their relationship. It was much more physical attraction. But she notes that he sees something beyond that. He sees relationship. The word peace is not just this. It's not just the absence of friction and war and conflict. It's relationship. And so, even at that early stage, she seemed to sense, I believe, that there was more. Now, the word peace, shalom, is followed immediately by the name Shlomo, which is built off of that same word. It's Solomon's name, his proper name, and it means peaceful. So there's a play in the singing here. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. Now, where is this? Don't know. Baal is not just the thunder and lightning god. In the time of King David, in the time of Solomon's kingdom, and for probably 50 or 60 years thereafter, Baal was a Canaanite word for Lord that the Israelis had adopted into their own vocabulary, and they used it to refer to God, the true God. It was a synonym for Adonai. And so this is probably a reference to some sort of higher hill or mountain, perhaps even where God has a worship site at one time, and that's why it got this name. Hamon, I was trying to remember what Hamon is here, see if I can find it real quick. Pomp and circumstance, or crowds. So it has the idea of noise because there's a big bunch of crowds involved. And so it's possibly a place where worship had once taken place in the name of God. But the point is, Solomon had a vineyard there, and he let out the vineyard to keepers. So he leased the vineyard out to people to take care of it. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. So that was the cost of the lease. But she's using it in her singing here to make this point. Verse 12, my vineyard, which she's used before as a reference to her own body. My vineyard, my very own, is before me. Now, this time, I don't think she's thinking about her body. I think she's thinking about her boyfriend's body. And so then she says, you, O Solomon, may have your 1,000 pieces of silver. And the keepers of the fruit, they can have their 200. I'm not interested in that, all that wealth. I'm only interested in my boyfriend, the love of my life, the one that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. And so I kind of love that part of this, is that you can't put a price on true love. Then we have his final singing. O you who dwell in the gardens, with companions listening for your voice, let me hear it. So it's a final let's sing about love. Let's sing about relationship and wanting to hear the voice of those that love us and that we love them. And she sings back something that she's already done before. Make haste, my beloved. Be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So hurry to me. Hurry to me so that we can continue our relationship. And then the opera's over. And so you have to make your mind up, and I don't think it's definitive, as to whether or not at some point they end up married before we get to the end of the opera, or whether this is left open-ended, that the relationship continued, and at some point in our imaginations, the two end up married together and serve in the palace and in the administration of King Solomon as a married couple. And I'd love for that to be the way that the story ends. And so that finishes the last of the wisdom literature that we're going to go over at this time in our study. Because I do not believe that the book of Ecclesiastes is a production of King Solomon or of King Solomon's time. I know that that is a very common belief among commentators, but I am part of the minority that believe it comes a couple of hundred years later, and I believe that it is a production of King Hezekiah. I believe that when King Hezekiah had his life crisis, when he was told that he was going to die and he begged for more time and God gave him 15 more years, that he began to realize that life is fleeting, that life is like a vapor. You cannot control it. You cannot grab it and hold it and save it for later. It is lived moment by moment. Out of control. It is full of randomness. I believe that Hezekiah, coming to that understanding, began to try to find the meaning of life, and that the book of Ecclesiastes is his journal, his record of trying to find meaning in fleeting life. And even though it's a spoiler, I'll say that he comes to the conclusion that when everything is said and done, we have a responsibility to fear God and keep his commandments, because we will have to give an account for how we use his gift of life. So hold on to the book of Ecclesiastes for later in our study, Lord willing. Now, unfortunately, we have to turn our attention back to the story of King Solomon and how he falls apart. And so 1 Kings chapter 11, let me get there as well here, chapter 11, verse number 1. King Solomon reigns for 40 years. His 40th year, his final year, I believe started in the fall of 942, and I think he died sometime in the next year after that, before the fall of 941. And he would have died before his 60th birthday easily. Because he wasn't to his 20th birthday before he began to reign as king. His reign starts off so very well with him being humble and acknowledging that he, as a young person, was going to need God's wisdom in order to do well with the people of God. He acknowledged that God was the overking, he was the underking, and that he needed God's guidance in order to be a good king. And so he is blessed by God for that. And so we see him get to build the temple complex, and then we see him build his own palace complex. And I think that's where things start going bad. Now, he was already marrying many women as treaty wives. That's very political. It was common practice in the ancient world, particularly in the ancient Middle East. God warned against it, but we know that Saul did it first, then David did it, and then we know that King Solomon started down that path as well. I believe that that practice picked up a lot of steam once his palace complex was finished and he began receiving even more visitors from all over the world around his empire. And remember, his empire stretched from the Gulf of Aqaba, the branch of the Red Sea on the south, all the way to the bend in the Euphrates River on the north. It was bordered by the Mediterranean on the west, and it was bordered by the empty quarter of the Arabian Peninsula on the east. And so everything around that, they knew about what was going on inside of the empire of Solomon. They were impressed by it, and they were constantly sending representatives there, or sometimes kings and queens themselves came to meet with King Solomon. And so I believe in many of those visitations, King Solomon was pressed to marry another treaty wife, or at the very least, marry another business contract concubine. A concubine is a wife that doesn't have as many rights and privileges. Typically, they don't have a right to have an heir with the king. And so that becomes the downfall. We know because of 1 Kings 11. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh. Now, we already knew about the daughter of Pharaoh. He was married to her very early on. It's possible that David helped make the contract at that time for him to be married to this princess. She lived in the city of David, that oval town to the south of the Temple Mount, during the early part of King Solomon's reign. She was not allowed to live in the palace of David on the north side of that city because the Ark of the Covenant had been in there. Solomon at that time was very specific about keeping foreigners, non-Jewish people, out of places that were considered holy. When he built his palace complex, he made a special house for her in the new city, which would be just the south side of what we call the Temple Mount today. Because the temple itself would have been where the golden Dome of the Rock is today. So we know he was married to her as a foreign woman. And now the prophet writer tells us that he was also married to Moabite and Ammonite and Edomite princesses. These three people groups are related to the Israelis by blood. Moab and Ammon are descendants of the daughters and of Job and his daughters, which would have been, you know, the nephew of Abraham. The Edomites come from Esau, the brother of Jacob who becomes Israel. And so these are related people groups, but they are worshipers of other gods and goddesses at this time in history. The Sidonians, those are the Phoenicians, and the Hittite women, they are the remnants of a great empire that had once sprawled over the entirety of the Middle East. Verse 2, from the nations concerning which he who is had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they be with you. Now, this is not about their ethnicity. It's not about their gene code. That's not the problem. Here's what the problem is. For surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. It was because of the foreign religion of all of these peoples. Because these ladies, when they came to live at Jerusalem, to live in their palaces or their special residential palaces set aside for them, they brought with them their own personal worship. And so they had been warned, the Israelis had been warned, don't marry outside your faith. And Solomon did it anyway. Solomon clung to these in love. So he was committed to them by treaty and by business contracts, but he also had relationships with them. When you are in a marriage, you give a little bit of yourself to that other person, and they give a little bit of themselves to you, and that binds you together. That's why it's supposed to be one man, one woman together for a lifetime, because we are bound to that person. We become one with them. And so when you've got polygamy like this, you end up in relationships with way too many. Verse 3, he had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Remember, the heart is not the seat of emotion for the Israeli people. It's the seat of intellectual choices. So they convinced him to go along with them. For when Solomon was old, now we're not talking about ancient. Like I said, he never reaches his 60th birthday, it seems. So when he's in his later 40s, in his 50s, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to he who is his God, as was the heart of David his father. So the beginning of the bad end for Solomon is that he becomes a polytheist himself. He abandons the monotheism of Hear, O Israel, he who is our God, he who is one. He is the only one. Solomon begins to worship a pantheon of gods. And this is where he loses the relationship with the true God.